something to put my notes on. I used to be an extemporaneous speaker. That's a very good word. Now, in my dotage, I've got to speak with notes. Have you got anything to put notes on? How about this box here? Is this?
That's all right.
What is it?
Collection box.
I don't get scared when I take the thing out because it ain't that big. The speech here. Talking about a... I got a story to tell. I'm supposed to tell a joke, you know, to start this thing off. And it concerns Bob Hope. He was flying one time from Algiers to Paris on a plane, and the plane was struck by lightning. And everybody aboard was very much frightened, including Mr. Hope. And he recalled what his mother had told him as a child, that if he was ever in a position he didn't know which way to turn, he should do something religious. So he says, I did. I took up a collection. I don't intend to do that here. A couple of months ago, I was down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to the Louisiana Conference. And one of their speakers there was a Catholic priest from Baltimore, Maryland. Down there, when they have a convention, it lasts 3 days. And I had to make 3 different talks. But this man was telling his experiences as a priest, and he says he got fed up, and he decided to get out of the priesthood and go to the West Coast and live as a beachcomber. He'd been reading Hollywood, I guess, and anyway, he didn't make much money, and all his money came in quarters and half dollars and dollars, and he kept them in a bag, and when he had 200 bucks, he started west. And he got as far as Fairfax, Virginia, and he stopped off to have a drink, and that's as far as he got, which isn't very far from Baltimore. After he ran out of money, he called somebody in Baltimore, and they came and got him and put him in the booby hatch. And that's where he found out about AA. Came time for him to make his fourth and fifth and eighth and ninth step. And he was trying to tell this counselor whom he had of all the people that he carried resentments for. And he was telling him, yeah, that guy, that Gorsov, and this Gorsov. And the fellow says, I don't understand the word. What does Gorsov mean? He says, greatly overrated SOB. Now, that's the worst I'm going to swear tonight. As everybody knows, my name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. And when we get old, you know, and maybe have a few more years of sobriety than you, we have a tendency to preach. And I would like to stay away from preaching by telling you perhaps my story. And to begin with, my father died when he was 39 years old, and I was 1 year old. And my mother was not at all well, and I got shunted around from pillar to post, from aunt to uncle to cousin to boarding house and boarding schools and so on. I finally wound up in the Navy. But at the age of tender age of one, why, you didn't know anything about your father, and all you could learn about him was when you got older, you asked people, and they all said he was a fine man. All except one kid, and he said, your old man died of drinking whiskey. I was 6 or 7 at the time when this was thrown at me, and we had an awful fight, and I went home to my mother, and I said, what did my father die of? And she said, why, he died of complications, which is a big word for a kid, a little kid. But I had a counselor down the street about 3 blocks, and he drove the team for the fire department. They had teams in those days. That's how far back I go, man. And old Mac was my counselor. I went to see him when I had a problem because I had no father to go to. And I said, did my father die of drinking whiskey, as that Moffat kid said, or did he die of what my mother said, complications? He said, you know, I was afraid you'd ask that someday. Let's put it this way. One of the complications was whiskey. So it seemed to me, and when I was searching back, that even way back there, I felt a little inferior to the other kids whose fathers were still alive. And although they, most of them were shanty Irish on the west side, and they drank more whiskey than my father did, they were still alive. And but it rankled me that it had killed him. And I found out later that he'd been up trying to beat this deal. He'd been up to the Keeley Care at Dwight three times. In 1895, 96, and 97. Well, I got in World War I. I got over on the other side. And I went with the gang. I drank the Vin Blanc and Vin Rouge and Cognac and Triple Sec and so on. But I never had a compulsion to drink. I never wanted to drink the next day. Alcohol had no place in my life, no major place. And the fellows liked to take me along because I always got them back to the ship. I never got stiff. And after the war, I went on the road for a large corporation, selling a product that I used during the war. And I traveled. And the first sales manager I had was an old experienced head. We then had prohibition in this country. And I was being assigned some southern territory. And I traveled and called on the GE and Westinghouse jobbers. And he told me, he says, there's an awful lot of drinking down there in the south, corn liquor. He said, I'm not telling you to drink, but I don't want you drinking on my time. He says, don't drink before sundown. He said, if you start that, it'll get back to me, and you and I'll have to part company. So I went along for a good many years. I drank at night, and gradually it started to creep up on me, and I used to miss a day or two at a time. And he finally transferred me up to Detroit. And that's where I found out about this good Canadian whiskey across the river there. And all we had then was a ferry boat. We didn't have any bridge or any tunnel. And they had a pretty loose way of bringing whiskey over. I mean, you could always come over with 2 pints on you, nobody'd bother you. And I remember the day I came back with two fellas that I drank with there. They were luscious. And I didn't consider myself one then. And we got up to the hotel on Saturday night in Detroit. I had found that the best way to stay out of trouble was to live in a stag hotel. Because those babes would get you in a lot of trouble. And I was staying in the stag hotel, and they came in my room the next morning, and I was sitting on the edge of the bed. There was a pint unbroken on my dresser. And one of them, his name was Joe Parent. He opened it up, and he took about that much in a water glass and threw it down. He says, ah, now I can go to mass. And the other guy took a pretty healthy slug, and they both went away to church. But before they did, they induced me to try a drink. And I said, no, I'll get the tomato juice and the coffee, and I'll shake it off as usual. But they didn't hold me down, but they encouraged me. They said, look how fine we are. And I went in the bathroom, and the first one came up, and the second one came up, but the third one stayed down. And then, of course, I had to put another one down to hold that down, and that stayed down. And the Frenchman hit me on the back, and he says, now you are a drunkard. And by God, he was right. Because after that, whenever I had any sickness in the morning, you know, I could take a couple of slugs and get down to that office and leave a note for the boss, gone to Grand Rapids or gone to Flint or wherever it is, and get out of there and shake it off that day and then come back the next. I thought I was getting by fine. Catches up to you. And an instance of that was that after I had been fired or allowed to resign from this good job I had, I wasn't worried. My mother was living in Minneapolis with my sister. I sent her $100 a month. Never miss. I had $4,000 or $5,000 in the bank. You couldn't consider me a drunk. And I started taking jobs selling on commission, where you could make a fast buck. And I was in a blind pig one night. That isn't as bad as it sounds, but it was a place where they sold drinks in Detroit. A fellow came in, a hail fellow well met, and he sat down, and we bought back and forth, and he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, nothing right now. I'm at liberty." He says, "Boy, get in with me." He says, "We got something that's really going." It's about the time that neon signs were being made in a large size. They used to make them small, but now they were making them successfully large. And the company he was with, they didn't sell signs. They came around and find out if you wanted one, and they would erect it, put up all the steel, give you a 10-year contract. You paid so much a month. And it was very small, so much a month. But you got your commission just as soon as they accepted the contract, the company. So I went along with this fellow for a while, and he gave me a territory. And I met a fellow downtown in Detroit, and he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm selling neon signs." He says, "By golly," he says, "you know, I'm head of the hotel now. I'm hotel manager, and our board was discussing signs the other day, but they're too expensive." I said, "I got just what you want." So we went in and figured, and I got an artist design down to him, and in about a week, while we had closed the deal, and in about another 10 days, my check came through for $700. That's for a 10-year deal. So I went on a $700 drunk. I mean, it was a little bit too much at one time for me, you know. And I got started, and I came back in about 10 days, and walked in like nothing had happened. He says, "Where you been, Slim?" Well, I said, I got that pleurisy, and I can't work when I get the pleurisy. He said, "Well, you can call, you can phone." I said, "Why bother you?" I said, "You didn't lose any business." "Okay, go back to work. No more pleurisy." So a couple of months later, another big one came through, and the check came through from Chicago. He handed it to me, or he held it out, and he says, "What are we going to do with this?" And I says, "What do you mean, we? I earned it." He says, "You remember the last one?" I said, "Yes, very well." He says, "Well, you better find out some way to handle this." So I took the check, and I says, "Look, when I need you running my business, I'll let you know." So on the way back to the hotel, I thought it over, and the more I thought about it, the madder I got, and so I went in and got a drink, you know how it is, and got started. And about the third day, I says, "Well, I ain't got a job anymore, so why fool around here?" I packed up and went to Chicago and shook it off there, and I went up to the same company. And I said, "The fellow was telling me you can make money at these signs." And he found out I had some sales experience, so he sent me out with a fellow, and pretty soon I had a territory, and I was producing, not the big stuff yet. I've been there about 3 weeks, and he called me in, and he says, "Slim, I understand you get pleurisy." And he said, "No, don't let that bother you." He says, "You and I are all right yet. We've got offices in every city, but if you ever get pleurisy here, you just keep on going." Well, you know what the end of that was. Now, I was the type of fellow that, in order to make a living, I had to have a front. I had to have a suit of clothes. and a tie and a white shirt, shaved up, and free from odor. And that last is very important. So I decided that go home to Minneapolis. I went there to bury my mother, and decided to get off the road and stay around where I could make some real friends and live in some place beside a hotel and try and make something out of myself, because I could see I was slipping. And I went to work on a newspaper. I did real well. And then I got on an awful twister there one time, and I just simply couldn't get off of it, and I woke up down in a flop house. I had sold my clothes. I sold my shoes, and I had a pair of what they call loaners on. The way you work that, you take a $10 pair of shoes on, and they give you a dollar pair back and $4 or something like that, and you're out your shoes. And so I had nothing to work on, and I didn't want to beg. I became a bum. And I didn't like it down there, but there wasn't much I could do because this stuff had me. Now, at one time, I had been to a Kelecure, and the old doctor there, he says, "You're pretty young for this." He says, "You sit down and figure out what that last drunk cost you." And I sat down, and to the best of my ability, it cost me $1,200. He says, "All right, you're going back into the same job, and you're going to meet the same people, cover the same territory, and have the same temptations. Now, when anybody keeps shoving a bottle at you or urging you to take a drink, you say right out loud to them, $1,000. And they'll say, that's what that drink could cost me. That's what the last drink cost me. And they'll leave you alone. He says, "I've seen it work. I've seen dozens of guys that have used that. And I used that for 18 months. That therapy of fear, they call it. Fear of $1,000. And then I got down to Jacksonville, Florida, between Christmas and New Year's. Nothing to do. The Seminole Hotel, full of wonderful babes, you know. All holiday cheer. And St. Patrick walking around, and he'd been, I must be cured by now, I haven't had anything for this long time, so I took a few drinks, and you know the inevitable happened, and I cracked up in Memphis. So, I had found that there was nothing I could do when this terrific compulsion got a hold of me, and once I started, there was no way I, short of going to a hospital or something to shake it off. And I still had one friend, a man left in Minneapolis who believed in me. And in 1938, he came down and looked me up, and he says, "There's a man up there at the Curtis Hotel by the name of Kitchen. And this man is teaching something that they're using in the East for drunks." I says, "Oh?" He says, "Yes, it's something called the Oxford Movement." And I says, "And what is the Oxford Movement?" He says, "Well, I don't know." He says, it's a sort of a businessman's religion." Well, just as soon as I heard the word religion, I said, "That's enough of that." Because that had all that kicked out of me as a kid. Well, he said, he got a little mad. He said, "Would you sooner be here as a bum, or would you sooner go up there and expose yourself that something might rub off?" Well, I said, "Even if I did want to go up, I couldn't go up looking like this, because I was a tramp. Had old clothes on, and I smelled a high heaven." So he took me into Nate's, which was a clothing store there right off of Washington Avenue, and took off my old clothes, and for $15, this was back in 1938, remember, I came out with a pants and a coat that matched, and a white shirt on, black tie. And he didn't have any bath in there. He loaned me a Gillette razor in the back, and I was fairly presentable, except for the odor. And my friend drove me up to the Curtis Hotel, where I met Mr. Kitchen and 12 or 14 assorted gentlemen, very well dressed. And they were all Christian gentlemen. And they were there discussing the Oxford movement, which to me was Greek. Now, this was their third day, and they had already discussed the first two tenets of the Oxford movement. Now, here are the six tenets, T-E-N-E-T-S, are steps of the Oxford movement. These are very, very brief. First, admitted he was powerless to solve his own problem. Second, he got honest with himself as never before, made an examination of conscience. Third, he made a rigorous confession of his personal defects. Fourth, he surveyed his distorted relations with people, visiting them to make restitution. Five, he resolved to devote himself to helping others in need. And sixth, by meditation, he sought God's direction for his life and helped to practice these principles at all times. Those are the six tenets of the Oxford movement, which antedated AA by many years. Frank Buckman evolved the thing. He died last year. And this being the third day, these 12 or 14 men had already discussed among themselves the first tenet, admitted he was powerless to solve his own problem. And number two, he got honest with himself as never before, made an examination of conscience. And they were about to begin, he made a rigorous confession of his personal defects. So the guy about three off from me, he starts off by reciting his fifth step to all of us. His defects of character, the things he'd done and all that, you know, the people he'd hired. And most of, when it got down to me, I thought, my God, what did I get into, you know? Me with my sense of guilt and my hangover and this polished gentleman there telling me what adulterers they are. And I'm not being a married man. I wasn't confused with adultery, you know. I wasn't exactly a virgin. But when it got to me, I says, gentlemen, I says, this is very confusing. I don't know what it's all about. The only thing wrong with me is I drink too much and I don't know how to quit. I'll pass. And it seemed to me, in my sense of guilt, that they all pulled away from me. What's this guy doing here, you know? Boy, he smells funny, you know? So they went, two more fellas past me with their fifth step, and then they called a coffee break. And I got out of there. And I went down to Nate's, and I got my old clothes back, and I got $10 back on my suit. And I went out and got drunk. Well, I don't blame the Oxford movement for that, because the Oxford movement has helped thousands of people. But it was too rich for my blood. I couldn't handle it. Now, these men who were up there trying to get a hold of something were Christian gentlemen of Protestant belief. And they discussed there, while I was there, the fact that where the church falls down, and where they need something like this in connection with their faith, is that the only one who benefits at a service generally is the clergyman. He spends all week preparing a talk, a lecture, a sermon. He gets up there and he gives it himself. They sit there and take it in, and they're edified, and they go home and they shut up. They don't help anybody they don't pass it on. And that's why they felt so frustrated about their Christianity, that they weren't doing their share, and they wanted to find out how to help somebody else. Now, in August of 1940, I was still confused and a bum and everything else. I went in the public library in Minneapolis. It's the one that's torn down now. And I was looking for some escape literature, a detective novel or something to read to escape from the butterflies and fuzz. I was coming out of one. It was a hot day, and I was very aromatic. The old sweat was coming out of me, you know. And I wasn't drinking champagne. So I was looking for this book, and right here in front of me was Alcoholics Anonymous, the cover of a book. It was a paper cover. And the first edition of the book, the paper cover was red and yellow and black. It was very vivid. You could spot it across the room. It was meant to be vivid so you could see it. And here I was looking at it, and I was afraid to take it off the shelf for fear somebody would connect me with alcohol. You'd be the same way. You don't want anybody to know that you're an alcoholic. And we didn't have the word alcoholic back in 1940. We were drunks. So when nobody was looking, I took it off and took the cover off quickly and went over and sat down in a big, deep chair. And I could hardly hold the thing, you know. And I got to How It Works, Chapter 5. And I remember the line, "These steps are suggested as a means of recovery." It's the first time anybody was ever suggesting anything. Up to now, anything I read about alcohol, particularly Dr. Seliger's 35 points, this is what you gotta do, this is what you must do, so on and so on. And that isn't very good prescription for an alcoholic to read. He'll say, "The hell I do." But here was something that said suggestion. Now, this was on the library shelf of the new books, and they charged 10 cents a week to take that out for 7 days. And I didn't have the 10 cents. So I put the cover back on the book, put it in there, said a little prayer that it would be there when I got back. I had my sister's library card, unbeknownst to her. It just had her initials on there. And I went out on the stem and I bummed a dime. I says, "Can I get a dime to take a library book out?" And the guy looked at me and he said, "Boy, that's a new one. He give me a quarter." And I went in and took that book out, and I took it up to my friend that night, and I says, "I can't read this. I can't make sense out of it. I'm too shaky and confused. Will you read it and tell me what you think?" He sat up all night and read it. Now, this guy is not an alcoholic. He's dead now, but he sat up all night, and I met him the next day, and he bought me a meal, and he said, "This is the answer. Get in the car." And he says, this makes sense," he says. He says, I think after you get cleared up, you can accept it. And he says, "There's a post office box there to send away and buy one, so I'm going to buy you one. Where will I mail it?" I said, "That's a good answer. I don't know. I haven't got any place to live. I'm just at liberty." And so we were going up First Avenue South, and he says, "There's a room for rent." So we stopped and went in, and he rented the room for a month. And it was a little light housekeeping room, and he gave my landlady $35 or $40, and he says, "Give this guy a buck a day only, period." And that was the address to which the book was sent. He sent away and got it. And I read it sober, went out and got a job, and a great big job, paid, I think, $35 a week. There was no end of the hours that you worked, but it was hard to get a job then. And they didn't pay only 2 weeks, so in 2 weeks I had almost $70 in one check. And I didn't know where to cash it. I went to the Valhalla, which was a joint, and they were so kind to me, they didn't even charge me a dime to cash it. They knew me very well. So I had to buy a drink in order to make up for them cashing it, you know, and I got home with $11. And so I knew I couldn't handle money. So I went to my fellow I was working for, and I told him what my problem was. I said, "Will you please, when you got another check for me, mail it the day before to my landlady, and I'll go out with her and cash it." I says, "This is humiliating, but I have to do it." So pretty soon in November, two men came up from Chicago to cover the Michigan-Minnesota game. They were newspaper men, and I knew one of them. But they didn't come around until about 10 o'clock Saturday night. They had my address from New York. And there was a fellow beat him to it, a fellow named Malloy. Never go around with a guy named Malloy. He had a quart of old granddad, and I certainly couldn't pass that up, you know. And we were about two-thirds down in this granddad bottle when they walked in. And my AA book was laying there, and he knew me, one of them did. And he saw what condition I was in, and he says, "I wanted to discuss Alcoholics Anonymous with you." I should go right ahead, boy, and you know. So they came back the next morning, and I was pretty, you know, I wasn't too sick. didn't make too much sense. So they were going back to Chicago the next day, and that's when the blizzard hit. I don't know whether you had it down here, the Armistice Day blizzard. And they couldn't get out of town for a while, and they said, Providence has sent this blizzard to hold us here. I said, nuts. I said, Providence wouldn't freeze 50 duck hunters to save one drunk. They said, he works awful funny sometimes. But I was impressed with their belief in Providence. And so I said, well, you guys are going back to Chicago now, and I'm going to be here alone. And my problem is, how am I going to get through Christmas and New Year's? I says, I've never been able to get through Christmas and New Year's for I don't know how long. He said, what are you worrying about Christmas and New Year's? How are you going to get through today? That's all you've got in your life is today. And they dwelt on that for a while, and it started to make sense. So I was alone, November, December, January, February, up until March. And they impressed on me the necessity for making the fourth and fifth step. But I was afraid to look inside of myself. I didn't like what I saw when I tried it once, so I passed that up. But being alone, I had to sit down and reason things out. And I had no difficulty accepting step one because it had me beaten and licked. And in step two, I said, Cronin, what do you think about? What comes into your mind when you're asked to think about God? What is your conception of God? Have you ever asked yourself that? So I was what you might call almost an agnostic. I knew there was a creator. I knew there was some infinite being, but I had lived such a life that I thought, what right have I to call on anybody for anything? But in casting around, trying to figure out what do you think about, what pops into your mind when you think about God, I had a very juvenile conception of him. And one of these uncles that I stayed with in my youth, he had an art book with some very famous paintings in color, a big one. And one of these paintings was a reproduction of the painting on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome by Michelangelo. He painted it laying on his back. Maybe you've seen a copy of it. It's called The Creation. A reproduction of an Old Testament male being, a tremendous person, long flowing beard, long flowing locks and robes, tremendous vitality, tremendous virility, stretching out his finger to touch an inert man lying over there. That was God touching Adam to bring him to life. That was his allegorical conception of the creation. And that's always what popped in my mind when I was trying to think of God, was that being on a cloud, and that cloud was a million miles away. So I could never get any contact with this being. So I had to get a new conception of what this power, this creative power, meant to me. And I worked out something like this. What did I believe in that I couldn't see? Well, I believed in this room, as you do, that there's oxygen here for me to breathe, for all of us to breathe, or we'd all die. I can't see the oxygen, but I believe it's here. I believe in this room there's music and laughter and pictures, but I can't see them. But in this atmosphere, they're floating through here. All I need is a radio and a television to bring them to life. They're here. And so I believe that in this room there's a creative power that we call God. And I have a finite mind, and you have a finite mind, and only God is infinite. And we cannot comprehend the immensity of a being that we are told has no beginning and will have no end. So that is what we mean by faith, that there is a power greater than ourselves. Now, everybody in this room believes that there is a power greater than him, or he wouldn't be here. And that power is alcohol. And that's a negative power. So we've got to find a positive power which is stronger than alcohol and us, and that is the power that we call God. And anybody can believe in that, whether he's a Mohammedan, a Jew, a Christian, or a Buddhist. Anybody can believe in a power a power for good and not a power for evil. So then I go on with the steps and I come to the one that says, are you willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him? I said, sure, it'll keep me sober, but how do I do it? What is the procedure to do such a thing? Nobody told me. So I decided the way to do it was in the morning when I got out of bed. I had figured out long before this that the word humility, which hadn't had much place in my life before, meant my relationship with my God, not with my fellow man. I figured if I could stay humble before God, He would help me to stay humble and keep my arrogance down. And so I used to get on my knees at the bed, and I would repeat, this day I turn my will and my life over to You for guidance. Help me, please, so I can help somebody else. And then I would go on talking, as I would talk to you, tell you what I need. For this day I need wisdom and courage, and knowledge and tolerance, patience, understanding, charity, gratitude, and some health. Please, if I get these, I'll do what I can to help somebody else. And I'd go out and I'd face the day, and you know, it wasn't too long before the compulsion started to leave a little. I think I'm about the only guy that made 20 calls without a score. I went around to all the drunks I drank with until I got discouraged, and I tried to sell them AA. Look at me, I haven't had a drink since Armistice Day. So what? We've seen you fall on your nose before. You'll do it again. Nobody had any faith in me. Maybe you found that out when you quit. But it takes people a while to have faith in you. You've got to change a little. You've got to change the inner man. When you change the inner man, it shows in your eyes and in your demeanor. You've got a little more courage, a little more confidence, a little more guts than you had before. But I couldn't get any of these people, and one night I got so darn mad, I'd been to a fella that I thought, sure, I could get him to come in. He turned me down, and I said, well, everybody in town's drinking but Cronin, by Gardner, you know, and I was ready to put in the sponge. But I had one last hole, ace in a hole, and that was call this telephone number in Chicago and reverse the charges, which I did. I told him, I says, I've had it, by God, I can't get anybody to come in with me. He says, I thought something like this had happened. He says, you did better than I thought you'd do. He says, have you drank yet? I said, no. Well, he says, you take that book of yours and you go down to the Minnesota Sanitarium and you talk to the drunks down there. They got their clothes taken away from them and they can't run out on you. You've got a captive audience. They got to listen. By God, I did that. I went down there and talked to those guys, and I knew that if I took a drink, I'd be laying right alongside of them if I could pay for it. And I think in all the time I went down there, I didn't get anybody immediately, but a dozen fellows came to me later on and said, it started to make sense. And then I got notice from New York that the first week of March, we're going to have a big spread in the Saturday Evening Post by Jack Alexander on Alcoholics Anonymous. And you go down and buy yourself some posts. Now, $5 to me then was like $50 now, but I took $5 and went down to the distributor, and I says, I want 100 posts for that issue. And he says, okay, I'll have them for you. And I went down and picked them up, and that was my literature. And a fella drive it up the room for me, and every judge in town got one of them. They only cost a nickel then, you know. And anybody that I want to influence, I would give them a copy of the Saturday Evening Post and say, now please read that. That's me. And we had a columnist up there, Cedric Adams. He was a lush. I drank with him. And I went to Cedric in March and I said, Cedric, I haven't had a drink since Armistice Day. He says, "You're a liar. I saw you drunk Christmas." I said, "That wasn't this Christmas. That was a year ago Christmas. Think again." He said, "Maybe you're right. What about this?" Well, I said, "I just told you I haven't had a drink since then. And this is what's keeping me dry. But I can't get anybody in with me." He said, "How long does it take to read?" I says, "Well, take it home with you. But I want you to put in your column today, anybody that wants to join Alcoholics Anonymous, and spell it right, please, to write your column. Write AA care of your column. You'll turn it over to the local chapter," which was me. And so he did. And the mail came in by the bushel, you know. But most of it was from wives and mothers and Aunt Minnie. Yeah. Two letters from home, maybe 20, 25 letters from men. And invariably, the men's letters said, "I know a guy who needs that." And you'd have to track them down and find out that it was them. They were the ones who needed it. But that's the way we got started up there. And they told me, when they left for Chicago, they says, "You keep watching for a man who's got leadership ability. And when you find him, you step down and let him carry the banner." And just as soon as I got these men in, first two men I got in, one was a hospital administrator and one was a lawyer. And I couldn't slough off anything on either one of them. They would take no responsibility. I wonder if that happens in other clubs. Or just two or three or half a dozen guys carry the ball and the rest of them say, "Yeah, yeah, that's good." But anyway, that was my experience. That I couldn't get anybody to do anything. I had to give all the classes up there for 4 years, 3 years at least. Till finally I walked out and I said, "There'll be no class tonight, there'll be no class from now on, unless some of you guys do it. Period." And I walked out. And by God, they got to work. And they've evolved the best instruction classes in the world. What was that? In the world, yeah. They're doing all right up there without me, and I knew they would. And I think that has to happen elsewhere. I think it'd be a good idea when you take your inventory tonight, or any night, say, "What have I done to repay Almighty God for today's sobriety? What have I done to help my fellow man who needs my help? What have I done for my group?" So, I kept stressing to them the steps 4 and 5 and 8 and 9, and I hadn't done it myself. That's how I still phony. Finally, in June of 1941, a fellow come up to me and he says, "Pat, I want to make my fifth step to you." You know, fifth step. Oh, yeah. So we had to go out. We just had a little bitty club room then, and we had to go out in the middle of a park where nobody could hear us, and he had his notes. And we sat down, and he unloaded on me, and we discussed it, and he went away feeling satisfied. He started sending me some business. Other guys that wanted to make their first step. And pretty soon a gal come up, and then I got frantic. Because I was going to have to live with these people, you know, and I didn't want to have to face them, knowing everything that they'd done, and worrying about whether they got that fixed up or not, or whether she was still pregnant or not, you know. And, oh boy, a lot of them had difficulties. So I went out looking for a clergyman. And I got him. And I also got an old retired doctor, old Dr. Snyder. He was 78 or 79. He says, "Sure, I've got a couple hours a day." And he was a good listener. And so we worked that out pretty good. And then I got to thinking, well, here you are. You're still phony. You're telling everybody else to take this fourth and fifth step and eighth and ninth, and you haven't done it. So I had to excuse myself on the basis that I didn't have time then. I got up at 6 o'clock and rode to work with a guy way out to an arms plant and got there at 7 and put in my time. Got back home. There was always two or three drunks sitting on my steps waiting for me. And I wasn't married yet. I was dry 1 year when I got married for the first time. She practically got a virgin over 40 years old. I had a couple of shotguns poked at me on the way, you know, but when they found out I was a drunk, they let me alone. This is my first step to you guys. But I decided that the only time I had to make my examination of conscience was riding to and coming from work, and I told the fellow I rode with, I said, I got to work out a problem. It's going to take me quite some time. So you'll excuse me for not talking to you for a while. Okay? He said, sure. So I made my inventory, going to and coming from work, and I finally thought I had a pretty thing. I had nothing written down, because I had a wonderful, wonderful brain and a wonderful memory. I was a genius. And I ain't anymore. But I called one of these clergymen up, and I made a date. And I went over there, and I had 7 or 8 or 9 of them great big ones right there in the front of my wonderful, beautiful brain to give it to him, you know, just as soon as my memory. And I walked into his study and looked at him. I thought, what did he think of me if I told him that? So I give him a lot of inconsequential stuff, and I walked out. I had them 7 or 8 still hanging on my neck, and I knew I'd failed. So I went back to my room. I hung a sign out, busy, do not disturb. And I wrote for 3 or 4 days after work. I finally got it in pretty good shape. I called this clergyman up, and I said, I would like to make another appointment. I left something out. He said, I thought you were awful pure. So, I went over there with it written down, and I started off wrong. I told him the worst one. I says, I'll tell you what I did, but I'll also tell you why I did it. He says, let's stop right now. I'm not interested in why you did it. You've been making excuses to yourself all your life. Cut it out right now. Just tell me. I'm making notes. We'll discuss it. I said, oh, boy. Do you tear them notes up? He says, never mind. Let's get it off. He says, you're the guy that was sending me all this business, and now you're starting to quibble there, you know. So I made a fairly good fifth step there and talked over the resentments I had and so on. And I don't know how silly one of these resentments can be. Stop me if you've heard this. I don't know how long I'm supposed to go. But I came across one of them when I was delving through. I wouldn't talk to my brother-in-law, see? I hated him. So I started to figure out, why do I hate this guy? And then it came to me. Now, a World War I bonus, none of you guys are old enough here for that, I know, but we got paid in 2 installments. Hoover said if he paid it all at once, it would bankrupt the country. I don't think the country owed $1 billion then, but we owe a few more now, but we got paid in 2 installments. Well, I wasn't quite ready for the first one, and bang, it went through my hands like that. I got the limit, and $2,500 deals. And I'd always wanted to go out and put a marker on my mother's grave. I had never done that. I'd gotten the money together 6 times, and then met a babe or something happened and drank it up, you know. So I vowed that the next time I got the $500, I would call my brother-in-law. I wasn't mad at him then, you know. And I gave him $200, and I said, now, my sister knows what I want, and you and her go out and get that put on the grave. I'm leaving with this gang. We're going to the West Coast. And I'll be back, but be sure and do it while I'm gone. Well, I had in mind a marker about that high, you know. For $200, you could do pretty good then. So when I got back, I went out to the cemetery and looked, and here was one of them markers, you know, like this at the head of the grave. I priced them $75 with all the writing on it, installed. And I had given the guy $200, see? Gee, did I blow. So I went downtown and got a little oil and oiled myself up, and I called him up and I told him what a heel he was. I didn't give him a chance to explain. And I said, you rotten so-and-so, keep the $200. Bang, and I hung up, you know. Never went near him. Any time I wanted to get drunk, all I had to do was think $200. Where? Perfectly legitimate excuse to get drunk, you know. Boy, was I misused. So here I had to get rid of this one, see? And I got to thinking, you better check. So I went out to the cemetery, and I got the superintendent. And I told him where the plot was, and the grave number, and so on. I said, I am thinking of taking that marker out and putting in one about this high. He says, have you looked around out there? I said, well, not necessarily. He says, in that area, they're all flat, so the mower can go over. We can't put one in for you. If you want a marker, you got to move the whole grave up on the hill. Well, I never thought of that. You know, I just never had sense enough to look that all the rest of them were flat, see? Because I was usually soused up when I was out there. And so I went out and humbly apologized for my being such a cad all these years. And I got to thinking, well, this guy's come out down and bailed me out and paid my fines and even bought me a suit once so he'd go to work. I probably owe him 200 more. So that's the way I got rid of one of the resentments. Now, if you ever wonder whether there's any changes in you, I found this out one time in August of 1941. I'm walking down 7th Street and I meet a man who knew me when. And he looked at me and he says, what happened to you? And I said, well, I quit drinking. My pants and my coat matched, you know, and I didn't stink, I didn't smell, and my head was up, I had a clean shirt on, wasn't sweating like I am now. And so right away he said, do you belong to that outfit that was in the Saturday Evening Post? I said, why? He said, well, I'm the arranger for the Lions Club. We want you guys to speak at a Lions Club meeting. He said, we got some alcoholics in the Lions. I said, I'll say you have. I knew a lot of them, you know. Well, I said, now, I don't admit I belong to anything, but I'll see if I can find these guys and see if I can get you a speaker. So I went that night and I asked the group conscience, which is a good thing to do, gentlemen, what shall we do here? Somebody has to come out of hiding and tell these people what this is all about. So they talked it over, and they, in their wisdom, they said, well, you call your man up, your booking agent, and you tell him that you'll speak, but you have to be introduced as Mr. X. So I called him up, my lion friend, and I said, all right, I'll come. But I have to be introduced as Mr. X. He says, okay, okay. 3 weeks from Wednesday, the Radisson Hotel at noon. Be there. So my friend went back to his office, and he got his stenographer. He sent out penny postcards in those days, you know, nothing in an envelope. And on the back of that, they stenciled, Mr. Pat Cronin of Alcoholics Anonymous will speak on alcoholics, and blah, 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 and they sent it through the mail to every lion in the Twin Cities, see? Very good advertising for me, you know. I didn't know about this, see, until I got down there that noon to speak, and a friend of mine pulled me aside and said, did you see this? And I said, oh, God. So he saw I got mad, this booking agent of mine. He stayed out of my way, you know. Somebody else introduced me as Mr. X. And he said, the fellow who was introducing me, he said, this is the largest gathering of lions we've had in years. And that made me madder yet, you know. I said, I know why you bozos are here. Morbid curiosity. You want to see what a self-confessed alcoholic looks like. All right, take a look, but by God, if you want to see some of my future disciples, look at the guy next to you. And then they all bust out laughing, and I got over my peeve too, you know. So, I suppose you meet people here, you meet people everywhere, who wonder whether or not they have reached their bottom. Well, I definitely knew when I had reached my bottom, because the only way I could go was up. But, now we have a fella. I checked on him the other day. He's 8 years sober. And he's the vice president of one of our large milling concerns up there. He has an enormous home. He entertains all the time. And in his home. But about 8 years ago, he was entertaining a large gathering. He came out of the fog about midnight, long enough to see that all his friends were picking up their coats and hats and getting out of there quick, wasn't saying goodnight, and his wife was putting the whiskey bottles into the case there, the whiskey case, and she locked it up instead of hanging the key up here. She put it in the First National Bank, you know. And then he went back into his blackout. But he woke up the next morning, and some of that stuck with him. And he went down and looked for the key, you know. No key. And he was too proud to ask, but he went downtown and had breakfast. And then he went and bought a bottle, took it up to his office, and he had an office bottle. That's the first time in his life he ever had one. And he was afraid to go in the club to drink, because he might meet some of these guys, and he didn't know what he'd said. And he snuck a bottle up to his room in his house, and after two or three days of that, he says, "What the hell's the matter with me? I was never like this before. I wonder if I'm one of them guys." So he called up Tom, whom he knew was sober and in AA. He says, "How about lunch?" And he talked to him, and he says, "I'm one of those guys." So he joined up. He entertains just as much as ever. He has just as much whiskey as ever in the house, but he don't drink. And he don't drool. He just made a complete surrender that he didn't need it. He had a very gentle bottom. I don't imagine any of us have had as gentle a bottom as that, but that was as far as he wanted to go. He didn't want to insult his friends. He didn't want to imperil his job, and he didn't want to hurt his wife. And he didn't want to lose his self-respect. He wanted the ability to look in that glass in the morning and remember everything that he had done. And in those days back there, when he started out, you know, if a fella come in under 40, we'd look at him, "What the hell are you doing in here? You ain't bumped your head hard enough," you know, things like that. But we found out that a fella can be just as hurt just as bad when he's in his 20s as he can. We've got one up there, 19 years old, who's sober 8 months, and he's doing fine. Now, each one of you people in here want to remember that 25 years ago, there was no hope for the alcoholic. There was no hope for me. And what has happened in our life is little short than a miracle. This is miraculous. A psychiatrist will tell you that. And by the way, I'm going to put in a plug for this psychiatrist who's coming to talk to us November the 9th. That's 3 weeks, isn't it? 3 weeks from tonight. He's coming up there to talk. He's a psychiatrist in Detroit named Al Church. Puts out a wonderful talk. If you can get up there to hear him, it's really worthwhile.
You people have more skill, if you use it, than any psychiatrist in the world, because you know what the alcoholic needs. The first need we supply the alcoholic is hope. Hope that he can get well, that all is not lost. For most alcoholics consider themselves hopeless when they come to AA, and they need assurance that there is a way out for them. The second need we supply the alcoholic is the need for being accepted, a need for being wanted by his fellow man. For most alcoholics have long felt rejected, that there is no one who cares about them or will accept them. And the third need we supply the alcoholic is the need to get rid of the burden of guilt and shame, which every alcoholic carries. We show him how to live with what he has done and how to feel free of the burden of it. He comes to believe that his past sins are forgiven, provided he is honestly trying to live the right way today. The fourth need we supply the alcoholic is to face up to the fact that he is an alcoholic and that nothing is going to change that until the day he dies. Every day of his life, as long as he lives, he must stay away from that first drink. The fifth need we supply the alcoholic is the need to face himself as he really is. He must learn about himself, face the facts, stand outside of himself, and look at himself with sober eyes. Most alcoholics, when they come to AA, are lacking an insight into themselves. They make erroneous judgments of themselves, of their motivations, and of their own strengths and weaknesses. In AA, an alcoholic makes an evaluation of himself, which is true for the first time in many years. And this is the beginning of humility. He becomes willing to live with the fact that he is human, with both good and bad characteristics, and that he will often have many bad moments. The sixth need we supply the alcoholic is the need to realize that he cannot stand still, that if he tries to stand still, he will inevitably go backward. He has to keep steadily moving forward if he is to prevent himself from slipping back. He must try to practice the AA principles in all his affairs as long as he lives. Any failure to do so exposes him to the likelihood of going backward, eventually to drunkenness. The seventh need we supply the alcoholic is the need to love and to be loved. The alcoholic wants to be loved, but he never gives love, and so he never receives it from others. The kind of love the alcoholic needs to learn how to give is an outpouring, giving and forgiving love that never judges, never condemns, never seeks praise for itself, and never expects a return or even gratitude from the person he gives this love to. In AA, he learns a deep, driving concern for his fellow man, a giving, never a demanding love. And the eighth need we supply the alcoholic is the need for faith in a power greater than himself, which will supply him with the power he needs to get sober and to live a better life. In AA, he learns to believe that he has achieved sobriety through the grace of God, that God has given him the free gift of sobriety. Gratitude for this gift impels him to testify to his belief in this grace force for good in the world, which is always behind him when he does the right thing. And in this great stream of goodness, he finds the power to face life and its problems and to have serenity and peace of mind amid the ups and downs of daily living. Another suggestion, or shall we say commandment, which was given to us centuries ago, is love thy neighbor as thyself. And too many of us forget the last two words, as thyself. We have nothing but self-contempt for ourselves. You mean to say that I've got to learn to love myself? Isn't that arrogance? No. Unless you learn to love the things you stand for, unless you are able to regain and keep complete self-respect, you will never be able to love your fellow man, and you will never be able to command their respect and their love. And that is what we are in this world for, to live in harmony and love and peace and usefulness. And don't forget, friends, that we as alcoholics are able to supply to the world two commodities which are very precious in the sight of Almighty God: human love, human lives, human happiness. Thank you very much.